Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
General Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian general who headed the Quds Force, a branch of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC. Meanwhile, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, an Iraqi, headed Kata'ib Hezbollah and was the deputy commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, known in English as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU. Both these men played a significant role in defeating al-Qaeda and ISIS, or Daesh, in Syria and Iraq. They formed an integral part of the axis of resistance and were instrumental in Iran's larger support for resistance movements in West Asia, including the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah. I wanted to ask the following questions. What did the work carried out by Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis mean for the region? How have things changed since their murder? And did the Americans succeed in their goal of weakening the axis of resistance? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On January 3rd, 2020, a commercial flight arriving from Damascus landed in Baghdad Airport. Aboard the plane was General Qasem Soleimani, who had come on an official visit at the invitation of the then Iraqi Prime Minister. General Soleimani was met by Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Meanwhile, circling overhead were a number of American aircraft. As Soleimani's convoy was leaving the airport, a Reaper drone fired on them, killing Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, along with four members of the IRGC and four members of the PMU. The shock of this incident was immediately apparent. Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, described Trump's assassination of Soleimani as the equivalent of the Iranians killing the U.S. defense secretary.
As to how to manage the fallout that comes from such a drastic action, this is the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the U.S. secretary of defense. If the Iranians were to assassinate the U.S. secretary of defense, we would consider that an act of war and we would respond disproportionately.
Trump knew full well that Iran would respond. How could they not? After all, Soleimani was one of the most important and powerful men in Iran, if not the entire region. The day after the assassination, Trump went on an all-caps tirade on Twitter, saying that if Iran responded, they would be hit, quote, very fast and very hard. He also threatened to bomb Iran's cultural sites, a war crime under international law. No U.S. president before Trump had dared to kill General Soleimani, knowing full well that it would be unjustifiable and could easily lead to war. Soleimani's body was brought to Iran to begin the funeral processions and national mourning. In multiple cities, literally millions of people flocked to the streets to mourn the slain commander. Just take a look at these clips from the funeral processions. General Qasem Soleimani was buried on January 7th in his hometown Kerman, after his burial had to be postponed twice because of how large the crowds were, a testament to his popularity. On January 8th, Iran began Operation Martyr Soleimani. In response to the assassination, Iran sent a barrage of rockets, firing a dozen ballistic missiles at the Ain al-Asad air base in Iraq. This base housed foreign troops, mainly Americans, and is located in Iraq, west of Baghdad. This volley of rockets leveled the base. There were no fatalities, however, it said that scores of U.S. troops were injured, many diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. Now, the framing of this attack is again very funny, because in the mainstream media, They were asking if Iran was ready to de-escalate the situation, as if Iran had just assassinated a U.S. official. And also saying things like, well, Iran is lucky. They're lucky they didn't kill any U.S. troops when they launched those missiles. Otherwise, we would have responded. Well, no, Iran didn't just randomly decide to launch missiles at the Ayn al-Assad airbase for no reason or because they don't like your clothes or your hair. They launched the missiles at Ayn al-Assad because you just committed an act of war and murdered an Iranian government official. It is, in fact, the United States who is lucky that Iran didn't do more. Now, the legality of such a strike has been at the center of debate about Soleimani's killing. Donald Trump claimed that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against Americans. Then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that killing Soleimani, quote, saved American lives.
It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work, and the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
It's probably a good time to mention that Mike Pompeo was also the former director of the CIA, where he also did this.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
Neither Trump nor Pompeo could provide any evidence to substantiate their claims about Soleimani. At first, they said that there was an imminent threat, but couldn't give a timeline when. They said days or weeks. Then Pompeo said that they had killed Soleimani because of something that happened in the days before the strike. But those are two completely different things. Something cannot be imminent if it's in the past. And it's not hard to see that Pompeo and Trump are lying and had no evidence of any so-called imminent threat. It seems the only reason Trump and Pompeo made this ridiculous claim about self-defense is because it's the only way Trump could legally justify the assassination at home under U.S. law. In 1973, the War Powers Resolution was passed, requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking military action. In the Trump administration's legal rationale for assassinating Soleimani, they cited the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2002, also known as the AUMF of 2002, which was passed under the Bush presidency for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is one of the most extreme, exaggerated interpretations of the AUMF 2002, which, by the way, was authorized against Iraq, not Iran. And nevertheless, that's just U.S. law, not international law. So just because Trump cites the AUMF of 2002, that doesn't suddenly make it okay on the world stage. Remember, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression and is considered illegal under international law. Trump also claimed that, quote, the strike against Soleimani in Iraq was taken in the United States national self-defense, as recognized in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, in response to a series of escalating armed attacks that Iran and Iran-supported militias had already conducted against the United States. Well, speaking of the United Nations disagrees. Agnès Callamard is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, and arbitrary killings. She concluded the U.S. murder of General Soleimani to be unlawful and illegal under international law. In July 2020, the Special Rapporteur published a report in which she examined the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. She rejected the United States' attempts to justify his murder. She found the U.S. to be in violation of the UN Charter and that, quote, the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful. Article 2.4 of the UN Charter forbids the use of force by one UN member state against another. She concluded that the United States broke this law. The examples of imminent threats provided by the US were in fact not imminent, but things that had already happened months before. Some of them were not even actual attacks, but rather perceived threats, while other examples included things like Iran shooting down a US drone that had illegally entered Iranian airspace. Sina Rahmani is a translator, scholar, and writer. His work has appeared in Iranian Studies, Radical History Review, and Public Books, among others. He's also the creator of The East is a podcast that takes a critical look at the history of the present in West Asia and North Africa. I asked him what he thought the motivations were behind the United States assassination of General Soleimani.
So two men represented and were, in addition to their own work as military commanders, effective ambassadors for their cause and their alliances, movers in their own political environments, and sort of the military aspect, and those aspects of their personality, they both were symbols of a resistance to the U.S. imperial agenda in the region that's been unfolding for three decades in different ways and in different backdrops. But they were the symbol of an alliance between certain forces in the region. They named themselves the Axis of Resistance. But whatever name you give to themselves, it's really just a anti-colonial sort of resistance front or anti-imperial resistance front. So that's the kind of general answer. But in reality, I think there are the sort of cold political calculations. I think that at the time we were in the midst of this kind of unfolding crisis, generated essentially at the behest of a highly placed sorts of individuals who more or less purchased foreign policy. And that was the sort of signature effect of the Trump presidency, is that he was honest in a way. The Saudis and certain factions among Zionists sort of hedged their bets and they invested in this guy. And that paid off in that unfolding crisis in those 2 years. And this was, I don't want to say culmination, but in effect, the most dramatic sort of theater of that unfolding drama that was ultimately begun by Washington, begun in those sort of like secret, you know, and unfolded over the course of those 2 years and resulted in the assassination of these two men. Extrajudicial killing, you know. It was totally illegal, and I mean, that's obvious.
I mean, we mentioned these cold, calculated foreign policy decisions. On that front, what was the goal? Why were the Americans trying to assassinate Soleimani and Abu Mahdi in terms of foreign policy objectives? And did they succeed? You know, if their goal was to change the Middle East, do you believe that they succeeded in that? And how do you think their deaths have affected the region?
In the sense of, like, you know, cold, hard calculations, nothing changes. I mean, nothing changes in the real... There are these two men played historic roles, yes, but ultimately they were reflections of a system of resistance that's been in production for a long time. And those systems have been tested in the last two decades of cataclysmic war being waged from all corners of the entire sort of West Asian region. And the Iranians emerged. There's a historic development in the last two decades. You know, this has been my adult life, is watching the U.S. empire make this insane, you know, like cataclysmic leap, you know, of ridiculous proportions of it's trying to establish its, like, you know, insane goals of regime change. You know, what was it, 7 countries in 5 years or 5 countries in 7 years? The General Wesley Clark thing. This is one chapter in a larger story of unceasing war fought by the U.S. against Iran, against its allies, and against anyone who doesn't want to go about being, taking its place in the supply chain, which is what it wants from ultimately the entire region, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the resistance goes on because it's a whole system of, countering colonialism, imperialism.
I mean, at a certain point, 40% of the U.S. military was surrounding Iran. I mean, think of that. That was the first phase. And then the second phase came their mercenaries for the, you know, which their first class one was ISIS, and then the rest of their allies, their supposed allies. And it was just like this team that rocked up and spent the last 10 years destroying the countries that they hadn't destroyed. And the response to that was what Qasem Soleimani's legacy. And we undercut the value of Abu Mandis, right? We should obviously sort of talk about that. But like both of these men and the forces that they represented and the alliances they represented and what they were, you know, leading members of, but ultimately were part of a larger sort of organism, that represented something historic. That's on the scale of the Spanish Civil War, where you had this fascist transnational alliance, except it was bigger than one country. And the response to it was a popular mobilization of normal people taking up weapons. And that's the legacy of the Hashd al-Sha'abi in the popular mobilization units, which were not a creation of Iran. It was, in fact, a creation of Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, right? That was Ali Sistani. So there's a lot of silliness when it comes to talking about Iran. And one of the worst things is this totally racist and totally bankrupt Orientalist thing of Iranians are the only ones who control things and the rest are their puppets. I mean, it's like Cold War stuff reinvented.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time, and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
So we know the excuses provided by the U.S. are not true. The United Nations and a large part of the world reject them. So why did the United States assassinate General Soleimani? The murder of Haj Qasem was part of a string of American hostilities against Iran. Trump quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Then he reimposed sanctions on Iran, crippling its economy, flying drones and bombers into Iranian airspace. Trump and Pompeo claimed that Soleimani endangered American lives. No, he didn't. America endangered its own troops' lives, never mind the people of Iraq, Syria, and others, by invading countries on the other side of the planet. This is not your turf. No one endangers American lives in the Middle East except America. You cannot invade foreign countries and then expect people to just shut up and tolerate being occupied. It's also quite amusing listening to the Western media try to explain who Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was. They say that he fought against American interests in Iraq, as if the Americans have any business being there in the first place after they invaded and occupied the country. That's like if you're talking about the French resistance in World War II and you say that the French resistance is opposing German interests in France. That's a very funny way to say that someone is resisting a foreign military occupation. Now, the United States claims that Soleimani was a terrorist. But Soleimani was killing terrorists, specifically the ones in Syria, funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and their allies. Soleimani's role in the region was an undeniably important one. Most generals today, whether in Iran or the United States, are unheard of. Most Americans probably have no idea who General Petraeus is, and he's one of the more known military leaders in the U.S. In Iran, with General Soleimani, it's a completely different story. He's a national hero and was known as being charismatic, and a general who led from the battlefield, not a desk general who sat comfortably away from the front. The Americans love to pretend that they care about minorities. They pretend to care for the Christians in Iraq and Syria. When Mike Pompeo spoke in Occupy Jerusalem, he claimed that General Soleimani was responsible for killing thousands of Christians across the Middle East. This is one of the biggest lies that has ever come out of Mike Pompeo's mouth, which is really saying something.
Qasem Soleimani. This is the man most responsible for the murder and maiming of hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Christians across the Middle East.
Neither Soleimani nor Iran has ever killed or targeted Christians in the Middle East. On the contrary, Christians who come from the Middle East, like myself, owe a huge debt of gratitude to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi because these men and their troops are the ones who protected Christians from being killed by Daesh. Meanwhile, it is the United States and Israel and people like Mike Pompeo who were funding Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra and terrorist groups like that, which purposely targeted religious minorities. This is why when Haj Qasem was assassinated, Arab churches in the region held mass for Soleimani and Christians prayed for him. Soleimani is not only dear to the Iranians, but to all the people of West Asia and the Levant who understood the role that he played in fighting the imperialists and their proxies in the region. Dr. Fuad Izadi is an associate professor of American studies at the University of Tehran. His work focuses on United States-Iran relations and U.S. public diplomacy. Izadi has also appeared as a political commentator on various international media outlets such as RT, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. I asked him about the important work General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi carried out in protecting minorities in the Middle East. Well, one thing that isn't really talked about enough is that Haj Qasem, Abu Mahdi, they really helped to protect minorities in the Middle East. Christians, Muslims, you know, everyone alike realized the important role that they played. Even after his death, after Soleimani's death, we saw Christians holding mass for him in churches, praying for Haj Qasem. I mean, isn't that a powerful example, a powerful testament to his defense of all kinds of ethnic groups and religions living in this region, defending them from terrorism and imperialism?
You know, this is something that the Western corporate media has generally censored the fact that Christians in Syria, the Christians in Iraq, were under attack by ISIS unjustly. Islam does not teach its followers to kill Christians. That's not part of Islamic teaching. And realizing that fact, it was actually Qasem Soleimani that was defending the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, no matter what the religion was. And it was very much true, as you said, that after his assassination, Christians in this part of the world lost someone who was helping them survive attacks by people who claimed to be Muslim, but they were not really following the teachings of Islam. And this very fact is, hardly see any coverage of that very fact, because Qasem Soleimani was supposed to be a terrorist. You cannot have a terrorist defending Christians. That's not going to be the frame that Western news media outlets want to present. So there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to how the media coverage in this part of the world is actually done. And it was Qasem Soleimani that highlighted this hypocrisy throughout his life.
You know, one of the things the United States likes to take credit for is supposedly defeating Daesh. Even until now, they claim that they're in Iraq because they're fighting Daesh. Realistically speaking, does the credit go to the Americans or does it go to Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? Because a lot of people seem to think that they should take the credit for helping to bring the downfall of Daesh. Do you agree that they had a much more significant role in combating all these foreign fighters, the terrorist groups backed by NATO and the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf?
Who was fighting terrorism? Qasem Soleimani. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. We have numerous accounts of the U.S. actually helping ISIS directly or indirectly. This is something that even some Western sources wrote after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that the United States assassinated the most important individual in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. talked about fighting ISIS, and in a lot of cases they actually helped ISIS. The country that fought ISIS, the military commander that engaged in that was Qasem Soleimani. So that's, if somebody's interested in fighting terrorism, somebody's interested in establishing peace, they should look at Qasem Soleimani as a hero.
So in the last weeks, we've seen reports that the Israelis were involved in the attack, or at least they've admitted to being involved in the attack. Trump allegedly said that he felt used by the Israelis. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that assessment that the Israelis used him? And what do you make of the Israeli role in the murder of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi?
But, you know, we had a retired Israeli general that just a few days ago said that Israel is very involved. And we had other accounts that actually pointed out that Qasem Soleimani was someone that not only fought against U.S. domination, and overall, you have a situation where Israelis are not actually in a better shape today when you compare their standing now to what happened to when Qasem Soleimani was alive. You remember just a few months ago, we had the resistance in Gaza, in Palestine, actually fighting back.
In the Middle East, General Soleimani is considered a hero because he defeated terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In the West, they call him a terrorist because he defeated their proxies, Daesh and Al-Qaeda. If the goal of the assassination was to cripple Iran or hurt Iran's military capabilities, that has obviously failed. Iran is stronger than it was 2 years ago by all reasonable metrics. Look how its military capability has grown and how the regional makeup has shifted in its favor. The United States had to flee Afghanistan. It can no longer sustain its occupation of Iraq. Its war against Syria has failed. If the goal was to demoralize the axis of resistance, that has also failed. The Houthis in Yemen are making huge advances as Saudi Arabia realizes it can no longer sustain this war against them. In Iraq, Soleimani's assassination prompted the Iraqi parliament to vote to tell the Americans to leave. And the Hashd al-Shaabi have become an even stronger force in Iraq, keeping the U.S. occupation on its toes. And while sanctions in Syria continue to take a strong toll, The project for regime change has failed and looks weaker and weaker by the day as Arab countries begin normalizing ties again with Syria. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has brought in fuel and helped to mitigate the effects of the de facto American siege with the help of Iran. And finally, Iran itself is in an even stronger position than it was before. It has more leverage in its nuclear program, a stronger relationship with China and Russia, and deeper ties with its neighboring countries. So by killing Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, did the United States succeed in weakening Iran or weakening the axis of resistance? The answer is clearly no. Iran and the resistance axis, they don't function like the USA or some random country. You cannot just kill one man, one leader, and then think, oh, everything is over. Now, while General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were certainly formidable tacticians and commanders in their own right, together they formed part of a system, part of the resistance. And you cannot defeat the resistance by simply killing one or two important individuals. Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi played a crucial role. This is undeniable. But the objectives of resisting against occupation, imperialism, and neocolonialism continue. And this is something that will only end with the complete liberation of the Middle East and Palestine. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. A Christian man by the name of Yusuf ibn Ya'qub was one of the politicians at the time of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Once, Mutawakkil al-Abbasi commanded him to go to his court. He was frightened since he knew that if Mutawakkil invites someone to his court, he will be either executed or tortured. Because of this fear, Yusuf ibn Ya'qub couldn't sleep during the night. Tomorrow morning, he was preparing himself to go to Samira.
یه همسایه‌ای داشتیم شیعه بود. رفتم پیشش گفتم شما شیعه ها.
When in the morning he was preparing for the trip, he went to his Shia neighbor and asked him, "Can I, as a Christian, resort to your Imam al-Hadi to solve my problem? Does he answer me too? I'm called to Mutawakkil's court and I fear going there." The Shia neighbor of Yusuf ibn Ya'qub answered, "Yes, our Imam belongs to all and his mercy befalls upon all. whether Muslims or Christians. Upon hearing this, Yusuf ibn Ya'qub became happy and said, "If Mutawakkil leaves me free because of the prayer of your Imam, I will give 100 dinars in charity in the way of God." The same thing happened, and Yusuf ibn Ya'qub understood that the mercy and blessing of the Shia Imams is not limited to their Shias only. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Hello.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
According to fresh data from the New York State's comptroller, the average bonus dished out to Wall Street employees jumped 20% to a record $257,500 in 2021, as big banks reported huge profits despite widespread havoc caused by the coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading "Jaw-dropping Wall Street bonuses have soared 1,743% since 1985. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis estimates that if the federal minimum wage had grown at the same rate as Wall Street bonuses over the past 3.5 decades, it would currently be $61.75 an hour instead of $7.25. According to fresh data from the New York State Comptroller, the average bonus dished out to Wall Street employees jumped 20% to a record $257,500 in 2021, as big banks reported huge profits despite widespread havoc caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Last year's average Wall Street bonus was the highest since 2006, prior to the Great Recession. The comptroller office points out that while the securities industry comprises just 5% of private sector employment in New York City, it makes up 1/5 of total private sector wages. Taking the new figures into account, Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies notes in a report that the average Wall Street bonus has soared by 1,743% since 1985. By contrast, typical American workers lost earnings power in 2021, Anderson writes, noting that high inflation has eroded the modest wage gains seen by ordinary people. Adding, average weekly earnings for all U.S. private sector employees rose by only 2% between January 2021 and January 2022. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Anderson adds, these jaw-dropping numbers are just the latest evidence of unequal sacrifice under the pandemic. While ordinary workers are struggling with rising costs for basic essentials, Wall Street bankers have seen their bonuses rise further into the stratosphere. Anderson argues that Wall Street bonuses have been soaring in recent years, partly because Section 956 of Dodd-Frank Act, a financial reform measure enacted in the wake of 2008 crash, has never been implemented. Anderson writes, powerful Wall Street lobbyists have succeeded in blocking Section 956, which prohibits large financial institutions from awarding pay packages that encourage inappropriate risks. Regulators were supposed to implement this new rule within 9 months of the law's passage, but have dragged their feet. Despite widespread recognition that these bonuses encouraged the high-risk behaviors that led to the 2008 financial crisis, costing millions of Americans their homes and liveliness. In contrast to the Wall Street lobbyists, advocates for the working poor have seen their efforts to raise the federal minimum wage and secure other important worker benefits stalled in Congress, she continues, adding, due to Washington's inaction, millions of essential workers continue to earn poverty wages, while the reckless bonus culture is alive and well on Wall Street.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam,
din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIV English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me ask you, Sheikh Javid, this question first at the beginning of this episode. You know, there are times like an emergency which happens to some individuals that they have to, in fact, break their prayer. Right?
Yeah.
Well, and they can't carry on their, you know, the practice of their prayer, and there might be consequences if they don't.
You're
so, in other words, I want to rephrase my question. What are the occasions, what are those situations or scenarios which, you know, in which the obligatory prayer can be broken?
Well, it is haram, the first one, as an obligatory precaution to break obligatory prayers purposely, you know?
Yes.
To break your prayer purposely is not permissible and without any excuses, okay? But if an excuse arises, then of course you can break your prayer. And for example, if you break your prayer in order to protect your property or to escape from financial or physical harm, for example, there's no objection to you. You can break your prayer. And it's permissible to break one's prayer for any worldly or religious purposes, which is actually crucially important for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if you see that something is being taken away by a strong wind,
mm-hmm.
and you need to protect it, or if there is, for example, wolf, you know, endangering your, you know, sheep, and the wolf is going to attack your sheep, you need to protect them, okay, then of course you can break your prayer and offer the prayer later.
Yes.
This is number one. And then it is also number two, it is also permissible to break your prayer if you have to either protect your life or the life of someone else whose life must be protected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it is actually obligatory for you to protect your life and to protect someone else's life. You know,
yes.
If someone is drowning and you are offering your prayers, it becomes obligatory to break your prayer. Because you have to do the thing which is more important, and the most important thing is to protect someone's life. So a drowning person is in need of help and you are offering a prayer, you know, that is not permissible. You must jump into action and quickly protect the drowning person's life. So this is number two, and the number three is, as said by the religious scholars, if a creditor
Mm-hmm.
creditor demands payment from a person who is, for example, praying, and if there is if there is ample time for the prayer to be offered, he should pay him, you know, at a later time. You know, he can of course break his prayer and offer his prayer, you know, later time. But if there is no time, he should continue praying. So
right.
The creditor is waiting for him. So if there's enough time to offer the prayer, he should break his prayer, because it's very important to repay your loan and not to keep someone waiting. Probably if he is in a hurry, you have to do it quickly. But if there's no time left and you're going to lose your prayer, maybe then you have to offer your prayer first and then give the money that you owe to someone.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have number four. I suppose if a person learns during his prayer that the mosque is, for example, impure, it's najis, and of course, and if the time is short, he should complete the prayers, of
mm-hmm.
course, because
yes.
he cannot miss his prayer.
Yes.
But if there is sufficient time, and of course, making the mosque pure
mm-hmm.
or purifying the mosque
is obligatory.
You know, it's obligatory.
Yes.
And he should, of course,
break the prayer.
He should break the prayer and purify the mosque, because purifying the mosque is a collective obligation.
Mm-hmm.
It is an obligation for every individual.
I see.
Who comes to know that the prayer is the mosque, the masjid is najis.
Okay.
So if one person actually undertakes to
mm-hmm.
purify the mosque and wash it or make it clean,
all right.
then others are relieved of the obligation to offer to, let's say,
okay.
To purify the mosque.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We were talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javid, in a situation, where one must break the prayer, if he goes on, if he carries on his prayer and completes his prayer, you know, is his prayer valid based on or in light of those situations?
You're right. Well, the prayer is valid, and of course, but the individual has sinned.
Yes.
He has committed sin for not taking action, like, for example, not saving someone's life or not protecting his property, not
mm-hmm.
protecting his life. Of course,
right.
he has committed a sin,
mm-hmm.
but anyhow, his prayer is valid, And of course, His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, has said that as an obligatory precaution, he has to repeat the prayer.
Yes.
He has to repeat it. Because In that case, in that scenario,
right.
he was supposed to leave the prayer and to break his prayer, but he did not do so.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Javid, can one individual break his prayer if he remembers that he did not, for example, or she did not recite Adhan and Aqama?
Well, if a person offering prayers remembers before the qira'ah, before reciting, let's say, Alhamd and Qul Huwa Allahu Ahad, Surah Ikhlas, or before going to ruku, for example, that he forgot to say the Adhan and Aqama, because Adhan and Aqama is recommended per se, you know. And if he has sufficient time at his disposal to break his prayer and offer the prayer again,
mm-hmm.
then it is mustahab, not obligatory.
Right.
Because Adhan and Aqama are mustahab per se.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot, they are not wajib. So also breaking the prayer is mustahab, and one can break his prayer and recite the Adhan and Aqama, because to gain the sawab of reciting Adhan and Aqama. And that's why Adhan and Aqama, according to the religious scholars, are highly recommended, and one should not leave out Adhan and Aqama because of the high recommendation, because they are very important to be recited. And the religious authorities, generally speaking, have said that if a person misses the Adhan and Aqama, even before ending the namaz, even if he is crossed, for example, the qira'ah and, you know, the ruku,
the salah,
and he is about to finish the prayer,
mm-hmm.
he can still break his prayer and start his prayer afresh. He can mm-hmm. repeat the prayer because he forgot to recite the Adhan and Aqama, and the Adhan and Aqama are highly recommended.
I see.
So it's permissible.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice elaboration and explanation of these rules and Islamic laws related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, the guest speaker and the producer, and the rest of the crew. We say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.